Impact of Influence, the tragic story of a powerful South Carolina family and the mysterious deaths they are linked to. Hello, friend. It's Matt Harris and Seton Tucker. So grateful that you are here with us. And you can reach out to us, Seton. Where, how, why?
You can reach out to us on our Facebook page, which is Murdoch Podcast, or on our website, which is murdochpodcast.com.
This is interesting because last episode, you brought up Eddie Smith, and we had audio from Eric Bland discussing Eddie Smith and what might come down, which was audio from a episode that we released a few months ago. But you brought it back up, and the timing couldn't have been better, Seton. You nailed it. Because the state grand jury of South Carolina indicted Alec Murdoch and cousin Eddie, Curtis Edward Smith, for criminal conspiracy and narcotics.
Right. So he was arrested, actually, last Friday, which is June 24th, in Colleton County, and he was transported to Columbia for his bond hearings, actually at the same jail that Alec Murdoch is at. So if you don't remember who Curtis Eddie Smith was, he was the person who was accused of trying to shoot Alec Murdoch last Labor Day in this kind of insurance fraud scheme. It was a suicide for hire so that Alec could get money for Buster.
Right. Let's go to the indictments. The state grand jury alleges, this is from the press release from Attorney General Alan Wilson. The state grand jury alleges a criminal conspiracy regarding approximately 437 checks, totaling approximately $2.4 million that went from Murdoch to Smith from October 7th, 2013 through February 28th, 2021. The two were also indicted in an alleged conspiracy regarding the distribution and purchase of oxycodone. Smith is indicted for four counts of money laundering over $100,000 regarding the alleged disposition of the checks. The state grand jury also charged Smith with forgery for allegedly forging endorsements on some of the checks. Smith is also indicted for three other drug offenses, including allegedly trafficking over 10 grams of methamphetamine. Altogether, through 16 indictments containing 81 charges against Murdoch, the state grand jury has indicted Murdoch for schemes to defraud victims of $8.5 million.
I mean, this is the first time we've heard about a drug connection. I mean, we've heard about a drug connection, but this is the first time from law enforcement that the distribution and trafficking of drugs being connected to Alec Murdoch and Eddie Smith.
Because we have heard about Alec's addiction to opioids. There's been a mention sometime over the last 8 months or so of the drug cartel or gang called the Cowboys that hangs out in the low country. And now there is a firm connection in Alec Murdoch purchasing drugs, allegedly, and he's being charged with distribution. So he had quite a few pills or some sort of methamphetamine or oxycodone. And Eddie Smith faces very wide range. It's what, three
to 122 years.
Yeah, that's quite a range. And so he was in front of the judge.
Yes, he was in front of Judge Newman, who is the same judge who Alec Murdoch was in front of. And let's hear what he had to say.
Smith, would you like to say anything regarding the bond?
Yes, sir, Your Honor, I don't have any money. All the money that Mr. Waters talked about, Alec Murdoch got all that. I didn't get none of it. I don't have any money. All I have is my disability I live off of, and that's it. I live in a modest house on a small piece of property. My automobile was 10, 15 years old. I don't have any access to money like that. People they were talking about at my house was renting a shop of mine that I had back in the back right there. He was doing some work in it. I don't know who all was in the shop right there at the time. I was in my house, you know, whenever this all was happening.
Anything else?
I'm not going anywhere, Your Honor. I look forward to clearing my name.
So Eddie looks forward to clearing his name.
And I found it interesting there that he talks about a shop that it sounds like he say he rented out.
And he says he didn't know who was back there.
Which makes me jump to, and we don't know yet because nothing has been released about the specifics, but it makes me jump to the thought that either the opioids were found there, or the meth or whatever it was either found in there, or they are saying it was produced in there or sold in there, because it seems to me that Eddie is distancing himself from what happened in that shop.
Yes.
So there could be something, some criminal enterprise that was going on in this shop, which will tie Alec and cousin Eddie into some, maybe some bigger scheme. I, you know, who knows? But that the shop thing really just jumped out at me.
We had to listen to it several times before we just kind of wrapped our heads around it.
Right. Now, we also want to mention that cousin Eddie, it said during this hearing, has been cooperating with authorities.
Right. So he did receive a bond. He did get a surety bond for $250,000 with the conditions of house arrest, an ankle monitor, and drug testing.
And he says he was dragged into the whole thing. I want to add to this, as we talked about the Cowboys gang, there's been many articles throughout the last, few months. One here from MSN that talks about the Waldorf area gang called the Cowboys, Waldorf, right next to Hampton, very close. And then I pulled it up and was bouncing around multiple articles about the Cowboys, including justice.gov released something in 2017 about arresting 8 members. But then as I just typed in the gang thing, this popped up, which I think was interesting, from Live 5 News. In 2013, a Live 5 News investigation uncovered a new violent gang in Colleton County. Collin County Sheriff's Office investigators say the Cowboys gang may be responsible for the murder of an innocent woman outside a nightclub on July 14th. They are now calling this gang the most violent gang in the country. Lieutenant Jason Chapman, who heads up the special response team and monitors gang activity, said, quote, "They're extremely dangerous, mostly because they're trying to make a name for themselves. They're bringing it to our attention through videos." And that really is starting to pop, that there might be a tie-in now.
Yeah. And people who are not familiar with the area, Waldorf is right on I-95. So, and it's, you know, Florida, kind of halfway between Florida and New York. So It does seem naturally that it would be a place that maybe drug activity would happen.
Now, we don't know, but those kind of whispers suddenly become more than just whispers. The next part of this podcast, we will warn you, is not specifically about the Alec Murdoch and the Murdoch cases. It's just something we thought would be interesting to those who've been following this or wonder about what the Low Country's all about.
Yes, we get a ton of emails and comments about pronunciations of names and places, so we thought it'd be a great time to bring on an expert. But if you are only here for Murdoch mess stuff, then you might just want to fast forward and join us again next week.
That's right. But and enjoy your lesson in dialect and language. Glad to be joined by a PhD assistant professor at the Department of Communication Disorders at the University of Alabama. He is Paul Reed. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
I'm glad to have you, man. You've also spent some time at the University of South Carolina with the Gamecocks.
Yep.
Was it because you were there that you started going into the Southern dialect, or you were attracted to the Southern dialect and then went to USC?
A little bit of both. So I grew up in East Tennessee and been fascinated by language and sound, you know, basically my whole life. And so I kind of had a little bit of a circuitous route to get to my PhD, but came to USC knowing that I wanted to study language and study, you know, language variation. Wasn't really sure where, and then took a class from Dr. Tracy Weldon while at South Carolina on varieties of American English, and kind of found my niche. And so, as a professional Southerner, I, you know, wanted to study home. So I started studying the variation among Southern English, and in particular in Appalachian English. So, but being in South Carolina for 7.5 years, you got to kind of get interested in just the cool history and all the variation in the Palmetto State.
I read your South Carolina Public Radio article, and you kind of described these four main areas of Southern dialect in South Carolina. So let's start with that.
Sure. So when you start thinking about South Carolina, I mean, it's kind of interesting because the state and how people refer to the state kind of give you a little bit of that indication. So you've got the Lowcountry, you've got the PD, you've got the Midlands, and then you've got the Upstate. And that roughly corresponds to you know, sort of the language variation there. So you've got the Upstate, which is more like Appalachian English. So it's basically take the Southern dialect and just most of the features are just more common, more frequent, or they take like the next step. So again, you know, you think you go past Columbia about 50 or 75 miles and you start getting into that. And by the time you get to Greenville, Spartanburg, and then on up to the, you know, what people call the dark corner, you're well in Appalachian English range. There in the Midlands, it's sort of a transition. There's a lot of Southern features, but you know, it's kind of dominated by a fairly large urban area. And so you get a little bit of difference because you have so many people coming from across the state and honestly across the nation with Fort Jackson there in Columbia. So you get a little bit of a difference. So there's still a lot of Southern features, but then it's sort of leveled a little bit because of just how much movement is there. But, you know, because it's the state capital, there's a large university, and then the Army post. So there's a lot of just there, but it's not quite as upfront as other places. When you start, start going to the east and you get into the PD, you start transitioning from that sort of leveled out southern to where you get into what we would call the coastal south. And there you have a lot of features that are where you get a lot more of the southern features, and I'm sure we'll probably talk more about those, but you get a lot more of what we call the southern vowel shift. But then in particular, because of South Carolina's relatively unique history as compared to a couple other southern states, you have more and interesting things. And then as you get into the Lowcountry, you have those same things, and you add in things like where R's after vowels aren't necessarily produced as much. Now, that's kind of on its way out, but it's still there, especially in the speech of people that are, say, 50 and older. I mean, depending on the person, they could be even younger in doing that. And then, of course, you kind of have Charleston, which is sort of its own thing, yeah. Which Charleston has that where there's no R's after vowels. That's sort of its traditional thing. But that's kind of been dying out. And then there's a couple other southern features that are found in most other parts of the state that aren't necessarily found in Charleston. So in most of the rest of the state, we have this sort of process called monophthongization. And so what that means is where in some words you have where there are two vowel sounds kind of mushed together. So it's like if you take the word M-Y, so my, mm-hmm. If you say that, you can sort of tell how that your mouth starts in one sound, the ah, and it moves to the E. So I, my. In lots of parts of South Carolina, people don't always do that. So they kind of just have one sound. So it goes from, you know, a diphthong, which means two sounds, to a monophthong, which is one sound. So that's why it's called monophthongization. So it goes from my to my. And that happens in lots of the state. You know, kind of happens in the Upstate, happens in the Midlands, happens in the PD, and then happens in the Lowcountry. Charleston is a little different because that didn't necessarily stick as much. So there are some cool papers coming around the turn of the millennium, and Charleston really didn't have that as much. It was kind of its own thing, and so that makes Charleston and sort of the and its surroundings a little bit different than the rest of the state.
So in Charleston, you know, the people I know that have what's called the Charleston accent, it's kind of a uppity, richy, kind of thing, right? Am I onto something there?
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of times because that type of Southern speech is one that was typically associated with a lot of upper class speakers historically. Mm-hmm. So right, you know that right. You know, let's go down to the hall, but we're going to see, you know, go to the ships in the hall. But that kind of sound there, that tended to be associated with people that had, you know, more wealth, just historically. Now, not everybody, but that there was that association made in the minds of speakers. Mm-hmm. And so that still happens to this day. So, I mean, you kind of notice that when, like, for example, when people win a statewide office or something like that, sometimes they sound a little more Charlestonian than they actually do in, you know, sort of regular life, or people that aren't necessarily even from Charleston might sound like that. And if you think about some of the like popular media portrayals of South Carolina, mm-hmm. people sound like they're from Charleston, even when they're supposed to be from Seneca or Greenville, or you know, somewhere. They don't sound like that in Greenville and Seneca, but you know, the portrayal of them is like that. Yeah, Charleston, kind of, and because of that historical importance of the port and the and how, you know, it was the holy city. So I mean, there was a lot of cachet to sound like you were from Charleston.
Now let's go to the Low Country where this whole Murdoch thing is happening. Seton, what would you like to ask him about that?
Well, I mean, we have gotten so many questions about the pronunciation of Alec Murdoch's name. So let's just dive straight into that.
Like, it's spelled, for those who know, it's A-L-E-X, which many people say Alex, M-U-R-D-A-U-G-H. In the beginning of this, when you heard national news, they were calling it Murdaugh, or sometimes Murdoch. And so there was different ways people are saying it. Explain how that breaks down.
So obviously when you see a name like that, it's a name from the British Isles, and just with that spelling with the A-U-G-H, that's kind of a big cue that that's coming from there. And if you look in the history of the name, it's a Scottish surname. And when you look back in the historical record, there are all sorts of spellings of it. When you get into Scotland, when you get into Northern England and into Scotland and also over in Ireland, they've not always been, well, English speakers, that they speak Scots and they speak other Celtic languages. And so they had different spelling conventions. And so that, you know, A-U-G-H sort of captured what we would sort of spell in English today as like O-C-K or maybe O-C or mm-hmm. or something along those lines. So right. that's so the but that sort of spelling convention captured the production of what would be like Murdoch. Mm-hmm. Now the vowel in the dock, where some people say it's almost more like, you know, dock, and some people say it almost sounds a little bit more like duck. It's just a matter of those are vowel sounds made sort of in the back of the mouth. And this is, you know, this is a very scientific term. Vowels are very squirrely. They move around mm-hmm. a lot, and especially vowels that are that sound, that aw sound. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that have two vowels, so they have like an aw and an aw. So that's like the difference in like C-O-T, caught, and C-A-U-G-H-T, caught. But there's also lots of people that don't have that distinction. So they say caught and caught. Mm-hmm. And they don't make a distinction. So that vowel sound is sort of one that it moves a little bit. And the cool thing is, so when I was looking back into the sort of the history of the name, that's been around for a long, long time. So like when you look back at how various people attempted to spell the name, especially when English, you know, people from England were writing about people in Northern England and into Scotland and thereabouts, they spelled it all sorts of different ways. So you've got D-O-C, you've got D-A-C, you've got D-U-C, you've got D-U-K, all sorts of stuff where that idea of what that vowel was is kind of, it's kind of squirrely. It just moves around because in English spelling, we don't do a great job of representing how things are pronounced and how we spell things. I mean, if you think about it, if you ask any of your friends or people that you know that grew up in, you know, nations like, you know, in France or in Spain or in Italy or lots of places, the idea of a spelling bee is kind of foreign, because if you can say something, you can usually spell it. But in English, that doesn't necessarily work.
Wow, I never thought of that. Yeah, it doesn't make sense sometimes.
Exactly.
How do we arrive at Alec?
Some people say Alec. Some people say Alec.
And that sort of gets into the southern U.S. speech. So that's a vowel sound that's made towards the front of the mouth, and so you get, again, just a little bit of difference, and especially because it's followed immediately by an L sound. And if you think about when you make the L sound, you know, you sort of raise the tip of your tongue towards the little ridge behind your upper front teeth, and air and sound go around the sides of your tongue. That sort of makes certain changes sometimes in the vowels around it, especially if there's a vowel before it. And especially when it's in that in that position, that sort of it can be raised a little bit and sound a little bit more like eh, and that's where you get that elik, the alec and versus elik, and then also there's a lot of people in that are English speakers just across the English speaking world, but also in particular in certain varieties in the U.S. that in vowels that are really short, they will make them even shorter. So they so the difference between like ah and is where your tongue goes. And if you have to immediately move your tongue to go make that L sound, you may shorten the vowel even more. So you're not going to get a full ah. You may get something that's a little bit more like yeah. And that's where the elik sort of comes from. And again, that's also associated with that part of the Lowcountry. Because again, there's some of those things sort of correspond to what we call that southern vowel shift, where those front vowels, so the sound in like ah sounds in like eh, and the sounds in e move a little bit.
So I was criticized because I actually mistakenly, and I'd seen the sign and I'd heard of the place, but I made the mistake of calling Okotie Okady. So what do you think about that?
So place names are notorious. Okay, so when I first moved to Columbia, you know, there's a street, H-U-G-E-R.
Huger.
And if you are not from South Carolina, you look at that and you say Huger, right? Or something along those lines. My first 2 weeks in Columbia, I was like, I need to get to Huger Street. And of course, people would give you that, oh, bless your heart, look. and then I would sort of get the correction. But so place names are always interesting because there's lots of places that don't always correspond, or you kind of have to be a local to know. And especially with what you did with the shifting of the stress, right? So which syllable is the longest and the loudest? So, whether it's Okotie or Okotie, you know, that's you're shifting the stress.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And honestly, a lot of English words tend to have stress on that second syllable, like you put it. But in the South, in certain parts of the South, we put a lot more stress on most of the initial syllables. So if you think about a lot of us have car insurance, and we carry umbrellas, and we celebrate Thanksgiving, and we celebrate Halloween. And we smoke cigars and we play guitars, right? So we put a lot of stress on that first syllable. So sometimes that extends to other words that again, if there's a chance to, I sort of tell my students and I joke, if you give a Southerner a chance to stress the first syllable, we're probably going to. So that's kind of what we do.
I recognize it when you say it, but I can hear it in my head a bunch of times about people saying that first syllable.
Right. You just don't think about it. Yeah. What about
exactly
y'all? I mean, let's go over the origin of y'all. Yeah. Oh, it is? Oh, good.
He likes his y'alls.
Yeah. So, okay. Y'all is fascinating. And so I'm going to briefly summarize, and I have to mention it because he was a huge mentor to me. He was the professor at USC, and he was on my dissertation committee. But a lot of this comes from the work of Dr. Michael Montgomery. Rest in peace. He was a fellow East Tennessean like me, fellow Maryville College grad like me, and he's the giant upon whose shoulders I stand. So he's a very special human. But he looked into the history of y'all. And so obviously, if you break it down, it's like you all, right? Mm-hmm. So it all stems from the fact that in older varieties of English, you could have, you had I, and then you had thou, and then you had you. So the thou was when you were talking to one person. So if you think about like in the King James Bible, and if you think in certain older literatures, thou is there, mm-hmm. and it's always talking to like what we would say today is you.
Thou shalt
but
not steal.
You itself was plural, so you were talking to a group of people.
Okay.
So and then over time, they kind of got where the thou fell out of favor and you expanded. So then now if you think about it. If I walk into a room and there's a few people in there, I say, how are you? It's ambiguous, right? It could mm-hmm. be I'm talking to one person, or I could be I'm talking to all of them. Mm-hmm. So in lots of varieties of English, we've done something to sort of fill that little gap. So now we treat you as being singular, and then we have something else for plural. So, in the most famous example is y'all. I think it's the best. But there's also people say like you guys.
Yeah.
People say yuns or yuans.
Yeah.
In Pittsburgh and thereabouts, they say yins.
Yeah.
In other parts of the Northeast Corridor, they'll say like yous.
Yeah.
And so there's all of these things that we've done to sort of make that plural you. Now, y'all is interesting because it sort of comes from two sources. There's the you all, which again sort of makes sense if you break it into like the you, but all of you.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another form coming from Scots and the Scots-Irish that was ye all. So basically it would be spelled today like Y-E-A-W. And if you hear, you all or you know, and you, as it gets mushed together, y'all, and then you hear ye all, and when it gets mushed together, y'all,
it's
very indistinguishable. And so you had sort of two sources that kind of mutually reinforced one another in and across the South. And so that by the fact that there were two sources that sounded very similar and it just sort of stuck. And then, of course, it's also incredibly useful. Like, I mean, anybody that has moved that the U.S. not a Southerner that moves into the South, the first thing they usually adopt is y'all.
Yep.
And I mean, because it's just so handy.
It is.
It is very handy.
And there's a lot of, you mentioned the Scots, because there's a lot of Scots, Georgia and South Carolina, way back, right? There was a lot of Scottish people set up home there.
Yeah, so when you think about the settlement of that the interior of the South, in particular, there's lots of Scotch-Irish, lots of Irish people came, different parts of England. A lot of the people that settled along the coasts were from southeastern England, which is why there's a lot of the coastal places have that they don't say the R's after vowels, and a lot of the people that settled in the interior were from southwestern England and in northern England and Scotland and Ireland. And so those places do say the R after vowels. And so that's why usually there's kind of in almost every southern state, there's sort of a coast inland split.
Right.
A lot of that goes back to sort of the first English speakers that settled there and then the subsequent waves. And then, of course, there's all sorts of other factors, the immigration patterns and migration and then other languages that were spoken there, the languages that were spoken before the English speakers arrived, all sorts of things like that, too.
Well, Scarlett O'Hara taught me that there was some Irish in Georgia.
also, the Gola. So what influence does the Gola culture have on the accent?
Well, we should explain. Most people don't know about Gola.
Oh, yeah.
Around the land, around the world. Like, explain the Gola before you go into their dialect, Dr.
Sure. So Gullah, sometimes or often referred to as Gullah Geechee, is what is known as a Creole language. It is actually, and this is sort of makes it really unique, it is the only English-based Creole in the continental United States.
Hmm.
So what a Creole language is, it's a language that arises from a meeting of cultures. Now, sadly, most of the Creoles arose from colonization and or enslavement. There are some others that sort of arose from like trade or some things like that. But the majority of the Creoles, which tend to be found in the Caribbean and a few other places, are, again, results of colonization and enslavement. What tends to happen is you have one group that has been displaced. And so if you think about like the Low Country of South Carolina, you have people stolen from their homeland in Africa, and they spoke lots of different languages. When you think about the West Coast of Africa, it's one of the most linguistically diverse places in the world. And so you have people that were from all sorts of different language backgrounds brought together. Now, and then they're put in an environment where English is sort of the lingua franca, or the thing that is spoken that everyone is going to use or needs to use, needs to understand in some capacity. So what happened in the Sea Islands of South Carolina and Georgia, there when you get in those situations, you have – it starts out as a language that for like a particular purpose. So again, that's where the colonization and the enslavement comes in. It's like you need to understand something. You need to have some communication. And so you tend to have a mixing of languages. Now, all languages, if you go back far enough, are mixed. So this is not – it's just sort of – it's a neat little like laboratory of sort of like longer things. So you have where one language tends to be where a lot of the grammar or a good portion of the grammar comes from. And then another language is where a lot of the vocabulary comes from. So we call that like the lexifier language, and lexicon is just a fancy way of saying vocabulary. So with Gullah, you have words that sort of were borrowed from English on grammar that is based on several different West African languages. Now, this is a bit of an oversimplification, but to get the point. So it is it's sort of where, and then over time, that language for a particular purpose of just trying to communicate with people that you don't share the same language, it gets transmitted to children and children. And you know, so over a couple of generations, a few generations, it goes from being a language for a particular purpose. So only, you know, for trade or for that colonization. And then it becomes and grows and grows and grows into a full-fledged, full-blown language that you can talk about art and literature and culture and feelings and hopes and dreams and sadness. And so it goes from something that you couldn't do that. So if you think about like the first few stages are like when you, as an English speaker, travel abroad and you're trying to buy something at a market and you've got like 50 words in whatever language. That's how they kind of start. And then it grows and grows as it's transmitted to children and it's needed to be used in different things and it expands out. So in the Sea Islands, you had an area that was, depending on the sort of the census records and the various records, was more than 80% enslaved Africans and about 20% English speakers. So you have to have that sort of big population differences for Creoles to really take hold. And so that's what it is. So it's an English-based Creole in North America, and it's found primarily in the Sea Islands of South Carolina and Georgia and inland into about Orangeburg in South Carolina. There's a good population of speakers and people that are from that culture. And so in the modern day, these are the descendants of formerly enslaved people, and they are, you know, they have Gullah. And again, it's one of those things when you hear it, it sounds like you might understand way more than you actually do. It's definitely something that if you want to read more about it, there's a lot of really good stuff that's coming out and has come out over the last, honestly, like 50 years. So it's really, really just fascinating. And it's something that is, there was a lot of stigma for, you know, lots of reasons that we all could probably point to.
Yeah.
But there's been a bit of a renaissance over the last couple of decades, which is just very gratifying to see, a lot of pride in the language and in the culture.
I did kind of want to ask the question. In the South Carolina Public Radio article, you mentioned that once people feared that accents would kind of die out due to radio and television, and explain why that didn't pan out.
So that's a really good, it's one of those things, it sort of makes intuitive sense, right? We watch the same shows. We listen to the same podcasts. We listen to the same radio stations. We watch the same movies. And so in some level, we would think that that type of sort of, you know, mass media that people are getting the same kinds of exposure, that they would change, that they would sort of lose that distinctiveness. But that really hasn't happened. And part of the reason is we learn language through interaction. And if you think about, you know, like if you've been around, you know, your children or your nieces and nephews or someone else's children, they learn to talk through either observing interactions, participating in interactions, you know, speaking with their parents, speaking with their siblings, speaking with their peers. And so that's how language is learned. You don't really learn language just by passively watching from like a screen or listening on a radio. Now, if you're really motivated and you're trying to learn like a second or a third language, you can.
Right.
But just when you're, you know, 9 months old to 18 months old to 24 months old, that's not really what you're doing, right? So the fact is that people still interact, and those regional varieties and the differences are there. Now, the language is always changing. So there have been some changes and some differences that, you know, so like the you know, what we would call like the New South or the Modern South doesn't sound like the South of, you know, the 19 teens, but it sounds like the South of today. And there's still lots of things that are shared with those earlier varieties of Southern speech, but there's also new stuff. And, you know, that same thing holds true. So if you still, you know, if you cross the Ohio River, people don't sound like they're in, they don't sound like they're Southerners anymore because you're not there. And that those differences are still there. And in some places, the differences are growing. And part of that comes from people want to sound like certain places, or they want to sound like certain groups, and then other groups don't want to sound like other groups. And so there's this idea of speakers wanting to sound a certain way or not wanting to sound a certain way.
Dr. Reed, you got anything else, Seton?
No, that's it. This has been really, really interesting.
Very cool.
This will be my husband's favorite episode because he finds it fascinating. He reads everything he can about that. I don't know what, whatever.
Dialect. And
dialect. He just loves it. He's so fascinated by it.
An accent and dialect, are they the same thing? Close?
Kind of. So when we think about accent, we usually talk about just the sounds. Mm-hmm. That some, you know, somebody has like a Southern accent or they have a Midwestern accent or something like that. And a dialect usually means more. It's not just the sounds. Oh. It's also maybe grammatical structures
and phrases
and other things.
Dr. Reed, it's been great, man. Dr. Yep. Reed, I really, really appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time.
Absolutely. Thank you all very much.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Well, there you go. We hope you enjoyed and learned, and you can reach out to us when you feel the need.
MurdochPodcast.com or on our Facebook page, which is Murdoch Podcast.
And MattHarrisPodcast@gmail.com. Hit that follow button if you would. Make a little comment and give us 5 stars and we'll be happy.